This is Tuesday, November 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. president talks about Donald Trump's election win.
You've seen some of the rhetoric among Republican elected officials and activists and media. Some of it pretty troubling and not necessarily connected to facts.
Also ahead, Jim Malone is here with a look at how Donald Trump is making choices about members of his cabinet. And VOA's Victor Beatty has the latest on a strong earthquake on the South Island of New Zealand. All on today's International Edition. U.S. President Barack Obama is in Greece, bringing to Europe much-sought assurances about the U.S. commitment to NATO under the presidency of Donald Trump. Before leaving the United States, Obama said Donald Trump told him he intends to maintain America's core strategic relationships. Athens is the first stop on the U.S. president's last foreign trip as president. Before leaving the White House Monday, the president said Trump had expressed to him a great interest in maintaining America's core strategic relations. And so one of the messages he said I'll be able to deliver is his commitment to NATO and the transatlantic alliance, said Obama. The president said he would let European allies know there's no weakening of resolve when it comes to America's commitment to maintaining a strong and robust NATO relationship. However, the U.S. president faced questions from reporters about Donald Trump's win in the November 8th election when in Athens today. Mr. Obama said one of the reasons for the Trump victory had to do with the resurgence of a populist movement fueled by many things, including globalization.
With technology combined with social media and constant information have disrupted people's lives, sometimes in very concrete ways. A manufacturing plant closes and suddenly an entire town no longer has what was the primary source of employment. But also psychologically, people are less certain of their national identities or their place in the world. It starts looking different and disorienting. And there is no doubt that that has produced populist movements, both from the left and the right, in many countries in Europe. When you see a Donald Trump and a Bernie Sanders, very unconventional candidates, have considerable success, then obviously there's something there that's being tapped into. A suspicion of globalization, a desire to rein in its excesses, a suspicion of elites and governing institutions that people feel may not be responsive to their immediate needs. And that sometimes gets wrapped up in issues of ethnic identity or religious identity or cultural identity. And that can be a volatile mix. It's important to recognize, though, that those trends have always been there. And it's the job, I think, of leaders to try to address people's real, legitimate concerns and channel them in the most constructive ways possible. Did I recognize that there was anger or frustration in the American population? Of course I did. First of all, we had to fight back from the worst recession since the Great Depression, and I can guarantee you if your housing values have crashed and you've lost most of your pension and you've lost your job, you're going to be pretty angry. And so we fought back and recovered, but that left, I think, fear and anxiety in a lot of people, a sense that the economy wasn't as certain as it could be and maybe the game was rigged on Wall Street or by special interests in Washington or what have you. And that's been there. I was also aware of it because of the fact that you you've seen some of the rhetoric among Republican elected officials and activists and media. Some of it pretty troubling and not necessarily connected to facts, but being used effectively to mobilize people. And obviously, President-elect Trump tapped into that particular strain within the Republican Party and then was able to broaden that enough and get enough votes to win the election.
President Obama will be in Germany on Wednesday before heading to Peru later in the week. Well, Donald Trump is trying to work out who will be part of his administration. Sources familiar with the situation say former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani is a leading candidate to be the country's next Secretary of State. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone is here. Jim, Giuliani has experience as a federal prosecutor, but doesn't have any foreign policy experience, at least any typical to those who have held the post. Another candidate reportedly being considered is John Bolton, a former ambassador to the United Nations. What do you hear about this? Why do you think he would pick Giuliani, if he does indeed, for Secretary of State rather than something as leading the Justice Department, perhaps?
It seems as though what's one of the factors driving the possible selections here is loyalty to Donald Trump during the campaign. That's not unusual in our history that presidents want to appoint people they're comfortable with, though we should point out there was an excessive amount of vitriol within the Republican Party as Trump rose through the ranks. Are you with him, against him? And people who have associated with Trump from his business career note that he's very big on loyalty, and those who are seen as disloyal, generally aren't welcome in the inner circle. So let's see how this plays out. I mean, this is still informed speculation about who's going to be what. I noticed that another member of the transition team has left, a former Congressman Mike Rogers of Michigan, who has a lot of experience in the intelligence area, and some people had considered him a possibility for, intelligence chief. Whether that has to do with this loyalty thing to Trump, I don't know, but there seems to be some elements of sort of turmoil emanating from the transition at this point.
And just to open that up even a bit more, I mean, some of the reports have said that it's almost like hand fighting in that Trump organization.
Right. But I mean, look, he was an outsider and he took on the Republican establishment, never mind Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. And now the tone we're getting from the Republican congressional leaders is deferential to him. They all want to work together. We just heard a little while ago from House Speaker Paul Ryan. So the congressional wing seems to be mobilizing to carry out what Trump wants to do. They still have a ways to go, though, in sorting out who's going to be in the administration and the cabinet. And the names that will come forward will speak not only to Trump's desire to deliver on his promises to his base supporters, but what kind of tone will it set as he tries also to try to heal the country that even President Obama said yesterday was an important aspect of what he needs to do.
But you got to realize there are thousands of jobs that are up for grabs here. Is that correct?
Sure. And it's going to take a while. I mean, they're going to focus on the big ones first, and the rest will follow. But we've already seen with Reince Priebus coming in chief of staff, sort of a nod to the establishment. But Stephen Bannon, this controversial figure from Breitbart, as his key political counselor, that again shows that desire to maintain links with those who were most loyal to him during the campaign.
There have been reports that Donald Trump might be seeking some top security clearance for his eldest children. Any confirmation of that? And why would he want to do that anyway?
Well, I mean, again, he has relied on a small inner circle, and the children were a key part of that. I don't know where that goes. I don't know what the ethics questions that might be raised in connection with that. Not only that, what about the ethics questions raised in connection with his various business holdings?
Who the children, the very children, the reports say he wants high security clearance for, will be running that business.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're in uncharted territory to a degree, so how this plays out. Sometimes there are not hard and fast laws or rules about how some of this plays out. So it's going to take a while to sort it all out.
That means Jim Malone, who has been working like four separate people all by himself over the past month or so, is probably in for another, a couple years at least for the same kind of schedule?
We'll see.
We thank you for being with us.
Okay.
That's always Jim Malone. And Andrew Palaszczuk is going to talk about social media. There had been some talk earlier today. Well, you just heard from Barack Obama saying social media, played a big part as far as this election was concerned. And Donald Trump, I believe, used it more than Barack Obama. I don't know that because Barack Obama, it's not Obama, it's Hillary Clinton. It's probably new to Hillary Clinton, is it not? But not all of her staff.
Well, I think we can all agree that Donald Trump used social media differently than any other candidate. And while that was an asset for him during the campaign, he connected with a lot of his supporters, kind of told it like it is. It's going to be an interesting journey along his presidency, how he manages his social media presence, how he kind of strikes that balance between being the statesman-in-chief, commander-in-chief, and somebody who has a lot of opinions that he wants to share and get out there on social media. So it may be, as we saw in the waning days of the campaign, there were rumors that his campaign had curtailed his access to Twitter. That might happen again as he assumes the presidency.
Who's the boss now?
Well, that's what we're going to have to find out. He's the boss of the land, but as far as the communications go, he may have some staffers who try to supersede that. We'll see.
The election, I would imagine, is still big on social media?
Absolutely. It's all post-election kind of fallout and staffing, as Jim was talking about. And Jim used the word turmoil, and we're seeing a lot of turmoil on social media about Steve Bannon, who was appointed chief strategist. Some of the things that he said on that Breitbart conservative website, anti-Semitic remarks, racial remarks that a lot of people are unhappy with. And interestingly, we're starting to see, as these names come out, Rudy Giuliani, Jeff Sessions, who is a senator from Alabama, a lot of even Trump supporters saying, wait a minute, I thought we were draining the swamp. And these are a lot of Washington insiders and established figures that we're seeing come into the administration. So it's interesting how quickly that narrative, drain the swamp, which we saw during the campaign, has changed.
So there has to be some frivolity on the web. On social media, is that correct?
There is. It's these kind of funny stories that pop up today. The story is that Donald Trump, when he goes back to Trump Tower in New York, they may have to shut down part of New York's iconic Fifth Avenue. And the one tweet I loved that someone sent out, they said, "Make America late again," due to the traffic. So we're going to see how New Yorkers already weren't big fans of Donald Trump in this election. I think they won't be fans even more so after Fifth Avenue gets shut down, if that is indeed what happens.
Well, make sure you stay in touch with Andrew Palaszczuk and me and everyone else here at VOA by doing what?
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at APAL. You're at VOA Melman. And the show is at VOA_IE.
Andrew Palaszczuk with us here on VOA. Among the top stories we're covering, President Barack Obama says NATO is absolutely vital as he seeks to reassure Europe about the U.S. commitment to the alliance under the presidency of Donald Trump. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani is said to be a leading candidate to be the next U.S. Secretary of State. Russia says its Air Force launched a major operation targeting Syria's Idlib and Homs provinces. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry tells VOA a ceasefire in Yemen could start as early as November 17th, provided that everybody does their part. That story is coming up. And an Egyptian court has thrown out a death sentence against former President Mohamed Morsi. Expanded coverage of these stories at voanews.com. On our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition, and this is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at the Pennsylvania State University have discovered that the mysterious and elusive astronomical phenomenon called fast radio bursts, or FRBs, can also pack a powerful punch of gamma rays. The FRB, discovered in 2007, is a powerful burst of radio waves that lasts only a few milliseconds. They are said to originate millions or even billions of light years from Earth and are not thought to be harmful. Penn State scientists say their research suggests that some FRBs may be capable of unleashing a billion times more gamma ray energy than radio waves. They may also come close to matching the power of gamma rays released by supernovae or exploding massive stars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Told you about this just briefly, just a few minutes ago. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says a ceasefire in Yemen could start as early as November 17th. That's 2 days from now, provided that everyone does their part. Kerry told VOA's Steve Herman that Yemen's armed Houthi movement and a Saudi-led military alliance have agreed in supporting a solution for the conflict in Yemen.
The Houthi have agreed for the first time publicly to sign on to sending representatives to the de-escalation and coordinating committee and to accept the roadmap, including the sequencing that is in the roadmap presented by the envoy as a basis for negotiations. And they support a negotiated comprehensive settlement to resolve the conflict in Yemen based on the framework that's laid out in the roadmap.
The Omani roadmap, as Kerry just referred, is based on an initiative by him. It's calling for Yemeni President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to hand power to a less divisive deputy in exchange for the Houthis withdrawing from Yemen's main cities. Kerry added the talks have a potential to be a real turning point. Make sure you stay with us here on VOA for all the latest information on that breaking story. This indeed is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the Voice of America.
We continue here on International Edition from VOA. Hundreds of residents and tourists are being evacuated today and tomorrow by military and civilian helicopters from the small New Zealand South Island town of Kaiakura. That's near the epicenter of Monday's devastating 7.8 magnitude earthquake that claimed at least two lives. The scenic coastal town is a frequent destination for those taking whale watching cruises. The quake's epicenter was about 90 kilometers north of the city of Christchurch, which suffered a 6.3 magnitude quake in 2011 that killed 185 people. An estimated 80,000 to 100,000 landslides have altered the landscape around there, cutting Kaiakura's road and rail links. Police said drinking water is running low, power was intermittent, and most people were sheltering in evacuation centers. Ken Elwood is a Canadian-born professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. He told VOA's Victor Beatty the powerful earthquake occurred at a shallow depth of just 23 kilometers in such mountainous terrain, and that was bound to cause widespread landslides.
There have been larger events down to the south, but in very remote areas where the impact on the built environment was basically negligible. You really have to go back to the 1930s to find a similar magnitude event that directly impacted the built environments in New Zealand.
Well, fortunately, the epicenter was in a remote area, as you indicated. Otherwise, the casualties, like the situation in 2011 in Christchurch, would have been higher.
Indeed. But that doesn't take away from the fact that there's a community of Kaiakura on the coast that is essentially cut off from access now. And so that's the big focus is getting access to that community and getting supplies in there, getting water and sewer running again. That's the focus. The human story still continues.
There are hundreds of aftershocks, I understand. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the aftershock sequence so far is consistent with other earthquakes where of this magnitude, we tend to see several large events in the days following, and so far it seems to be following the typical pattern.
Could you describe exactly what happened beneath the Earth's surface that caused this major quake?
It's a very complex earthquake, rupturing over several faults, three or four faults, and it's part of this complexity of the rupturing that led to the long duration that of shaking that buildings and people felt.
Does Wellington and other communities in New Zealand have a better infrastructure to withstand such quakes?
Wellington has been known for a long time. It is at risk to earthquakes and has been working to improve its infrastructure and buildings over many, many years. Wellington is New Zealand's San Francisco, if you will. It has been very proactive in terms of addressing vulnerabilities. But that being said, it is an old city. There are vulnerabilities. It is particularly dramatically situated on the coast with mountains all around it. And it's really that the access in and out of the city that becomes its greatest vulnerability as part of that access gets cut off in future events.
Ken Elwood said, like most earthquake events, a few seconds of terror is followed by months and billions of dollars in recovery efforts. New Zealand, with a population of nearly 5 million, sits on the so-called Ring of Fire, an arc of seismic faults around the Pacific Ocean where most earthquakes do occur. Russia said Tuesday its Air Force launched a major operation targeting Syria's Idlib and Homs provinces. The Defense Ministry said the operation includes warplanes from Russia's only aircraft carrier, the Admiral Kuznetsov, which arrived in the eastern Mediterranean last week along with several other ships. Tuesday's airstrikes were aimed at Islamic State militants and firefighters from the Nusra Front, according to Russian media. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director has been Patrice Martin, our engineer John Dryden. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Thanks for being with us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Last month, two newly elected pro-independence lawmakers in Hong Kong, Sixtus Leung and Yao Wai-ching, changed the language of their oaths of office. The Legislative Council barred them from assuming their seats. Hong Kong's judiciary took up the matter to decide whether the two would be able to retake their oaths and assume their office. Before the Hong Kong court handed down a decision, China's top legislative body issued an interpretation of the basic law that in practical terms said no second chance would be allowed. The matter is still with the Hong Kong judiciary. China resumed the exercise of sovereignty over Hong Kong in 1997 under the One Country, Two Systems framework enshrined in the basic law, which vests in Hong Kong executive, legislative, and independent judicial power, and also protects the rights and freedoms of the residents of Hong Kong, including freedom of speech and association. Regarding the recent developments relating to Hong Kong's Legislative Council, Deputy State Department spokesperson Mark Toner said the United States is disappointed.
The United States strongly supports and values Hong Kong's Legislative Council and independent judiciary, two institutions that play a critically important role in promoting and protecting the special administrative region's high degree of autonomy under the basic law and the One Country, Two Systems framework that have been in place since 1997.
We urge the Chinese and Hong Kong Special Administrative Region governments and all elected politicians in Hong Kong to refrain from any actions that fuel concerns or undermine confidence in the One Country, Two Systems principle, said Mr. Toner. Hong Kong's prosperity and stability depend on the successful implementation as provided for by the Joint Declaration and Basic Law. We believe that an open society with the highest possible degree of autonomy and governance by the rule of law is essential for Hong Kong's continued stability and prosperity as a special administrative region of the People's Republic of China.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.